What is a realistic date for humans to land on Mars? What really hides on the dark side of the moon? Is the moon a better place for a colony than Mars? And in Q&A Plus, do Dyson spheres or swarms make any sense? All this and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are, across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up. And I'll answer them here. I'm now in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, and we're here for another couple of days. Then we're going to move to the south, to the beach area, and then we're coming home. So on to the questions.
Pak Jahan, if we discover that ancient life found on Mars is linked to life on Earth, would Venus also be in line to have picked this up? So the idea of life moving from world to world, this is this concept of panspermia, and it seems fairly theoretically possible that if a large asteroid crashes into Mars, kicks up chunks of debris into space, the debris floats around for a few tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, it's able to protect life inside the asteroid. Then as it enters the atmosphere of another world, it heats up, breaks apart, but it doesn't heat up down in the middle of the rocks. And so the life is able to survive the journey. And, you know, we have examples of Mars meteorites here on Earth. We know this process is happening all the time. Some percentage of the meteors that we see in the sky, the meteorites that fall on Earth, came from other worlds, came from the moon, came from Vesta, came from Mars, theoretically have come from other places like Venus. We haven't found one, but theoretically, you know, these things are happening. And we're all quite excited about this announcement from NASA that Perseverance rover has found something that so far they haven't been able to come with a natural explanation for how it formed, apart from it being a residue left by life. And of course, you know, it needs to be studied in the lab, but it is an incredibly exciting discovery. And if it does turn out that this is bacteria that created this, and although, you know, we wouldn't be able to test the DNA to find out if we share a common ancestor, we would be looking at the kinds of things that the life is doing. And if it is very similar to what Earth life does, it does make sense that the life on Mars is related to the life on Earth. Then could it be that there's life on Venus? You know, people are fairly convinced that the conditions in the upper atmosphere of Venus could theoretically support life, that it's nasty down on the surface, but once you get high enough and your bacteria is aloft in the air, which happens here on Earth, right? We know there's bacteria aloft at tens of kilometers altitude, just floating around, then they've been able to work out a life cycle that life could survive. And there are extremophiles that with certain evolutionary changes might be able to live on Venus. And so if there were particles from Mars, you know, maybe there was life on Mars and then that was shared to Earth, because, you know, Mars is the lower gravity world that then makes sense that Mars could supply life to Earth and could supply life to Venus. If that's the case, then, you know, maybe it took thousands of tries, but eventually something was able to take hold on Venus. And so there could be life on Venus. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting places where once you start to think about it, there could be life. Obviously, we have all of the icy moons and icy worlds around the solar system that once you get down through the ice, you've got these conditions, liquid water, volcanism that is spewing nutrients into that water, various organic compounds, dissolved hydrogen gas that's food for bacteria. Those conditions would be perfect for life here on Earth. And so it could very well be that if life was getting around from world to world, it made it to Europa and Enceladus, and it made it to Callisto and Ganymede, and maybe all the way out to Pluto. And then you can even imagine more exotic ideas, like there's no life on the surface of the moon, but the temperatures increase. There's probably water in the interior of the moon. And so as you go down deep enough, you get to this place where the water on the moon is going to be a liquid, and there's plenty of rocks and material and various volcanic activity still inside the moon. Not very much, but still. Same thing in Mercury, right? That suddenly you start to go, well, life could be everywhere across the solar system, if life can get around from world to world, if hardy extremophiles can survive the journey, the arrival, and then find a place to set up shop, we might just keep finding life again and again and be able to trace it back to a common ancestor somewhere here in the solar system. Maybe even not on Earth. Maybe life formed on Mars and then moved around to the rest of the solar system. So we're really at the beginning days of this hunt, and we need to search more. We need to get better at finding evidence and bring it back to Earth where we can study it as we explore the solar system. Fantastic Al, what solar body, planet, moon, asteroid, or comet is the most interesting to study right now if you could choose? I mean, I'm most excited about Titan, I would say, right? Like Titan is this multi-layered world that is very interesting. Interior-wise, it's very similar to the other large moons in the solar system, like Europa or Ganymede or Callisto, where you've got this thick ice sheet, you know, that could be tens of kilometers thick. And then you've got this ocean of liquid water that's beneath that, that is surrounding a rocky center that has probably some amount of volcanism that is injecting material into the ocean. But then surrounding that, you have this layer of organic material that, because Titan is so far away from the sun, organic molecules are able to form naturally in cold conditions. And you have methane lakes on the surface of Titan. You have rain of methane. You have just organic molecules. They are the dirt on the surface of Titan. And so theoretically, there is some kind of process that is transporting material from the surface down into the interior of Titan. And you've got this mixing of organic material with the liquid water, with the additional, you know, dissolved hydrogen gas, things like that. And so you could have life, I think there, but that, and then it's just such weird terrain. Titan has an atmosphere that is thicker than the Earth's, that you could walk around on Titan and it would be very cold, but you wouldn't need a pressure suit to stop the low atmosphere from causing damage, the low air pressure from causing damage to your body. The mountains are made of ice on Titan. They're not made of rock, they're made of ice. Everything is so cold that sand dunes form of ice particles and mixed in with organic material, that there are these lakes, these seas of liquid methane that you could get, like a sailboat, you could sail on Titan around on these lakes, that you could send a submarine on Titan that could go down below the surface and head down to the bottom of the lakes. And methane is very optically clear. And so you could communicate from the bottom of this lake while your submarine is flying around to an orbiter that's heading overhead, that it wouldn't be like trying to communicate through water. It's very, very clear. You could fire a laser up through the methane lake and communicate. You know, imagine, think about a bottle of vodka, right? It's crazy. It's so weird and so interesting. It's so alien that anything that we have. And yet some of the conditions on Titan match what we might have had early on in the history of the solar system, of our own planet. So yeah, it's the world that I am most fascinated by is Titan. And then if I like had to pick, you know, the second one, it would be one of the ice giants, either Uranus or Neptune. Like, we have to go back to those worlds and study them.
It's time to shout out our new patrons at the $5 level and above: Robert Weiss, Stephen Magnuson, Adam Dong, Tim Humphrey, Jeff Harris, Adam Wenger, Astro Bonafida, Charles Lewis, Adam Garrett, and Carolyn Hart. Join our community at patreon.com/universe today.
Gurganescu George, if the moon is not more advantageous to colonize than Mars, it's closer and we can send help in case of need. Yeah, I think the moon is perfect. We're so fortunate that we have this large moon relatively close to the Earth that we can use as a place to practice our space exploration. That all of the things that we're going to need to do to be able to survive on Mars, we will be able to practice most of those on the moon. And the moon is harsher. The moon is a tougher environment to survive on than Mars is. And so if we can live there, we can live anywhere. But it's very close, as you said. And so if we send a bunch of explorers, you know, if we set up a base on the moon and they run into problems, we can send them supplies. If they really run into problems, we can rescue them. We can bring them home. We can send more astronauts up to help them out. So, you know, that's a place to test out all of your ideas, to find out what breaks, what fails. What do you need more of? Do you need more toilet paper? What's it going to take? Because once you send humans to Mars, they're on their own. There is no help can arrive for them. You know, it takes you 9 months to a year to be able to send a rescue mission to Mars. Matthew Moore, is there anything on the dark side of the moon? Well, this is the part where the will actually people will show up and say, well, actually, there isn't a dark side of the moon. There's the near side of the moon and there's the far side of the moon. But that's not entirely true. There is a dark side of the moon, right? Half of the moon is in shadow. Half of the moon is in sunlight. And so the part of the moon that is in shadow is in the dark side. And the part that is in sunlight is in the light side. Is there anything there? Yes. When we have a new moon, we are seeing the dark side of the moon. When we see a full moon, the dark side of the moon is on the other side of the moon. But for the far side of the moon, yes. Now, the moon is tidally locked to the Earth, so we always see the same side of the moon all the time. And so it wasn't until the space age that we actually could finally get pictures to see what it looked like on the far side of the moon. And when you are familiar with the near side of the moon, you sort of, you know, there's some craters, but there's also these big sort of dark gray areas, the mare, which are, we know, are old lava flows. On the far side of the moon, it's just pounded by craters. You don't have those old lava flows. So it's a very weird and unusual looking surface. And very surprising. That was not what people were expecting. They were expecting the far side was going to look kind of like the near side, but actually looks totally different. And that is one of the big unsolved questions, is why is the far side of the moon so different from the near side? You know, there's some theories at this point of why, that maybe there was like another moon that broke up on the far, you know, rained down on the far side, that the interior structure of the moon is kind of lopsided. And so we got more volcanic activity on the near side than we did on the far side. So still a bit of a mystery. But yeah, look at pictures of the far side of the moon. Very weird. Mark Oz. Fraser, what do you think is the most realistic date for humans to land on Mars? I imagine 2040 to 2050 is the most realistic, optimistic range, but no space fan likes this time frame. Yeah, I think 2040 to 2050 is realistic. That sounds about right. There are currently no concrete plans to send humans to Mars. Like, I know Elon Musk says humans are going to go to Mars any day now, but there are no concrete plans to send humans to Mars. The Chinese are gearing up to do their exploration of the moon by 2030. They're going to probably spend the 2030s exploring the moon, and then they'll probably feel like they have the skills to send a mission to Mars. So in the 2040 to 2050, let's say between 2040 and 2060, we will see the first human set foot on Mars. 2060, I'll be 89. Hopefully I'll live long enough to see the first human set foot on Mars. Let's climb. If you could build a Dyson sphere, would you really need a Dyson sphere? Seems we would have figured out scarcity by then. The whole idea of a Dyson sphere is purely just a thought experiment, which is that if you were some advanced civilization, you kept needing more energy, then eventually you would be harnessing all of the energy that was coming from your star. And if you were going to be harnessing all the energy that was coming from your star, what would that look like, right? It would look like a sphere of satellites that are buzzing around your star, that are overlapping, and they're catching every photon that is coming out of the star. But that is not necessarily the most efficient or effective thing that you could do. You could take your star and you could do stellar lifting on the material. You fire lasers at the poles of the star, and that causes streams, jets to come out of the tops of the star. And then you collect this material, and now you've got hydrogen. You can turn this hydrogen into energy using fusion in a way that's much more efficient than what the sun does. So I don't think it's necessarily about scarcity, although it could very well be, right? We could reach this point in our future evolution where we go, that's enough energy. We don't want to use any more power. We're now much more efficient and there's no need to use any more energy. Of course, that is always a possibility, right? It's not a thing that humanity has done in its million years of history, but it is theoretically a thing that we could do in the future. But also, there are plenty of other way more efficient ways that we could use the the material in the sun or in Jupiter or whatever to power our devices, right? That we would be able to use fusion energy instead of collecting the sunlight coming off of the sun. So it's just a thought experiment. Don't put too much sort of, I don't know, predictive power into the Dyson sphere. There's a great video that just came out from Angela Collier about Dyson spheres. And, you know, she quite accurately shows that Freeman Dyson probably was joking, was probably pranking, trolling people who were talking about SETI. So definitely check out her video. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can check that out.
All right, those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone, who put your questions into the YouTube comments, everybody who joined me for the live show. Now, I'm going to chat about a new smart telescope, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Bradley Griffin, Brian Bode, Caravan, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bailock, Cy Nielsen, Dark Finger, Dave Verbaugh, David Giltonen, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Sintz, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Parabach, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I've become quite a fan of smart telescopes here on this channel, and I've bought a C-Star S50 with my own money. The good folks at Veonis sent me a Vespera 2 smart telescope, which I've had a lot of fun with. There are a couple of other manufacturers that I'm keeping my eye on, and one that I haven't had a chance to try personally yet is the Dwarf telescope. And it's sort of in the same class as the C-Star, a fairly small telescope with a small optics, but has all of that sort of smart intelligence. And they've just come out with a new model called the Dwarf Mini. And the thing only weighs about 800 grams, so less than a kilogram, just a couple of pounds. The kind of thing that you can take on a trip with you. And I haven't gotten my hands on it, although we've got a review copy going to Dave Dickinson, who sort of handles all of the amateur astrophotography and astronomy information on Universe Today. He's reviewed all of the telescopes in the past, and so it's just going to be a matter of probably a month or so before he gets his hands on one. Or maybe they're going to send one to me, and I'll review it. But Trevor over at Astro Backyard got his hands on one and did a very comprehensive review. And it looks like it checks off all of the boxes, which is that you can record in the alt azimuth mount. You can record in the equatorial mount and do 90-second exposures. It's got a 30-millimeter aperture, but still, some of the pictures that he was producing with long exposures look really amazing. And you can also use the stacking on the telescope, or you can download all the raw data and then you can do your own stacking. I'm really excited about these smaller, less expensive kinds of smart telescopes so that really anybody can get into the astrophotography game and produce images that are as good as we would have hoped to have been able to do with a pretty fancy telescope setup 5 years ago. And now with something that just sort of like is about this big, you can absolutely just sort of throw in your backpack when you're going on a trip and if you're going to go to some dark skies and take some images that you'll be really proud of. Now, I'm not being sponsored by Dwarf. You know, none of these telescope companies sponsor me. They haven't sent me a copy. So I'm really just giving you sort of an advance what I think is going to be really useful for this. Definitely check out Trevor's video if you want to get more information about it. But, you know, we're kind of getting towards Christmas, and I think there's a range now of smart telescopes that you can purchase for somebody as a gift that isn't going to break the bank at this point. You know, they're not in the thousands of dollars. They're in the hundreds of dollars. All right. We'll see you next time.